This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, a now-retired Australian judge takes the extraordinary step of expressing his concerns publicly on the case of an anti-government protest group known as the Nauru 19. We'll have that in just a moment. Also, could Kiribati have a new president by the end of this week? A court ruling's paved the way for a vote of no confidence that's been motivated by the government's recent diplomatic switch from Taiwan to China.
The picture that this government is painting of Taiwan is that it is making it appear as Taiwan has been here to do harm to us.
And we'll hear about the Solar Buddies giving PNG kids a brighter chance at education.
It's been designed for children. It's got little eyes and arms and feet, so we humanised it a little bit. They put the solar panel out in the sun and it charges up, and then they use it at night to walk around their villages and study with.
Those stories and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Hello, I'm Catherine Grau. Well, first this today, a retired Australian judge has taken unprecedented steps and spoken out publicly and strongly to say he believes that the anti-government protest group known widely as the Nauru 19 will not get a fair trial in Nauru. The now retired judge, Geoffrey Mukey, initially presided over their case, and he was sacked last year shortly after he threw out the prosecution of the anti-government protesters. Anthony Stewart reports that his comments come after it was revealed by Pacific Beat that two members of the Nauru 19 are now seeking political asylum in Australia.
The so-called Nauru 19 have faced prosecution since June 2015. The group, which included a former president and includes a government minister and parliamentarians, was charged over anti-government protests that year. Successive Nauruan governments have sought to have them jailed. Retired Judge Geoff Mukey presided over part of the case. He's now turned whistleblower.
I, as a judge or a retired judge, would never do what I'm doing now in the normal course. It's not the role of a judge, even a retired judge, to speak on the public record as I am now. But I was so ashamed of what is happening in the judicial system on the island, let alone the executive government. I am doing it in the hope, but not the expectation, that it may help the Nauru 19 or what's left of them.
While serving on Nauru's Supreme Court, Justice Mukey ordered a permanent stay on the Nauru 19 proceedings. He was then sacked by the government. Geoffrey Mukey says Nauru has deliberately passed laws to limit the Nauru 19's access to legal representation, and this means they'll never get a fair trial.
Not now, no. No one could run this trial if he or she was representing all of the accused.
Have you ever seen, as a judge, have you ever seen conduct like this?
Never. Never. And it came as a shock to me that this conduct does or can exist in what otherwise are considered to be democratic communities, where the rule of law is said by the Minister for Justice to be honoured and be applied to every Nauruan citizen.
Australian aid and payments to operate the Immigration Detention Centre in Nauru represent a significant portion of the nation's budget. The retired judge says given Australia's financial support, the Commonwealth should consider intervening.
They should take some responsibility for ensuring that the rule of law operates in the country which they support to such a huge extent.
It's also been revealed two members of the Nauru 19 have sought political asylum in Australia. Squire Jeremiah and his cousin Rutherford are both former Nauruan MPs. He says they both fled to Australia when restrictions on their passports were briefly lifted.
Their own people are fleeing their country. This never happened to Nauru. This is the first time in the history that Nauruans are running away from their own countries. They're putting in a system that they brought in people from Fiji to dictate and deliver what they want. What they want is nothing but persecuting people.
The retrial of the Nauru 19 is expected to begin today. Stephen Lawrence has previously acted as a lawyer for the group, but he says they will not have any representation at this hearing.
There is no prospect of the Nauru 19 receiving a fair trial. We will see, maybe for the first time in this region, a mass trial of criminal accused who will take no meaningful part in their trial. They've been denied legal representation. The Nauru government has spent a small fortune on prosecutors. At no point have they spent a cent on the defence.
The trial is expected to take 2 weeks, but if the group is convicted, they'll likely be housed in a newly opened jail. Squire Jeremiah again.
According to David Adeng and Baron Wanga, they make fun about it. They tell people that this jail has been funded by Australia, built for the persecution of Nauru 19.
The Nauruan government did not respond to Pak Beet's request for comment.
That is Anthony Stewart reporting there. Well, 3 months on from the fiery Pacific Island Forum's leaders' meeting in Tuvalu, Australia is slowly mending relations with its neighbours. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is hosting several Pacific leaders in Australia for one-on-one meetings. Now, Mr Morrison's policies on climate change angered most Pacific leaders when they last met in Tuvalu. But since then, there has been a succession of low-key meetings focusing on other issues. Our Foreign Affairs reporter, Melissa Clark, is based at Parliament House in Canberra, where all the action happens. Melissa, the Prime Minister of the Cook Islands has arrived in Australia, just as the PM of the Solomon Islands has left.
That's right. Manasa Sogavare has just wound up a trip to Australia as Henry Puna arrives. And Fiji's Prime Minister was here just a few weeks ago too. Not to mention that Mr Morrison has visited Fiji within the last couple of weeks as well. So it's been a busy period of leaders' visits. For Henry Puna and Scott Morrison, they're going to have a one-on-one meeting today in Canberra and dinner at the official Prime Ministerial residence in Canberra, the Lodge. Now, it's a working visit, not an official state visit, so that means there won't be the pomp and ceremony that we saw when Frank Bainimarama arrived a couple of weeks ago. There's not an official welcome from the Defence Forces and the Governor-General, for example. But it is nonetheless a significant high-level meeting. Often these sorts of discussions are delegated to the Minister for the Pacific or the Foreign Affairs Minister. So the fact that Prime Minister Scott Morrison is taking the time to have a leader-to-leader meeting with Mr Puna while he is here in Canberra is certainly notable, and we can expect that they will discuss tourism and trade and investment and the Pacific Patrol Boat Replacement Program, as well as Australia's intention to open a High Commission in the Cook Islands.
All right, so that is the Cook Islands Prime Minister's visit. What about the visit by the PM of the Solomon Islands? How did that go?
Manasa Sogavare's visit was very similar. It was a working visit with that crucial leader-to-leader meeting. He travelled to Sydney and had a working dinner with Scott Morrison at his Sydney residence, Kirribilli, and with Mr Morrison's wife, Jenny. What they actually discussed has been kept under wraps. Because it's not an official state visit, there's not the formalities that come with a bilateral visit, so it's much harder to find out exactly what they discussed. But we do know a key part of the visit for the Solomon Islands was the receipt of one of the patrol boats as part of that Pacific Patrol Boat Replacement Program. In fact, Mr Sogavare went to Perth in Western Australia to receive the patrol boat. It's just the latest in a series. Australia has already handed over 5 boats out of a total of 22 that it is going to be giving to 12 countries across the Pacific and East Timor to help with maritime security and national security in responding to disasters with this extra naval support from these Guardian-class patrol boats.
Now, Melissa, it's certainly a quick succession of visiting Pacific leaders to Australia. So is it a sign of improving relations?
It is certainly more leader-to-leader level visits than we've seen in recent times. At the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu, there was a commitment to have more regular leaders' meetings. But at that meeting, there was a lot of friction between Australia and the Pacific leaders over climate change, given that the Pacific considered Scott Morrison's approach to the issue to be quite belligerent. Now, since then, it seems relations are improving. Now, whether that's because of a level of resignation about Australia's position when it comes to climate change or acceptance of it by Pacific leaders, that's hard to tell. But there's no doubt it is also a reflection of the pragmatic need of Pacific leaders to keep relations cordial and of Australia's need to ensure climate change doesn't define its relationships with the Pacific.
That is our foreign affairs reporter, Melissa Clark. Well, Australia is facing one of its most dangerous bushfire weeks ever seen, as large parts of the country's most populous state, New South Wales, faces catastrophic conditions today. People living in fire-prone areas have been seeking shelter, and whole towns are in virtual shutdown with hundreds of schools and businesses closed. Authorities have braced for the worst.
We've got every firefighter we can get. We've got every aircraft we can get. We've got military aircraft coming in to help us to look at rescuing people if people are stuck. Police have got aerial patrols making sure they're helping us look for new fires. There's no step I don't think we haven't taken.
Now, many fires have been burning in New South Wales and other parts of the country for weeks already, in fact. Firefighters who've been fighting them are certainly feeling the strain. Three people were killed and more than 150 homes destroyed in fires that swept through New South Wales and also Queensland over the weekend. And amidst it all, Australian politicians have been exchanging barbs about whether this is the right moment to be raising the issue of climate change. But in a growing chorus, experts and residents in affected areas are demanding more climate action, as Alexandra Beach reports.
The mayor of a northern New South Wales community reeling after the loss of at least two people in bushfires has issued a challenge to the nation's politicians. Carol Sparks wants a public conversation about how Australia deals with climate change.
When people's houses are burning and you've lost lives and you've lost friends and you've lost family, you don't think, oh, this is climate change. You think, what am I going to do next and how am I going to save myself? But the overall thing is we are so dry in this country. We haven't had rain for years in some places, and we need to look at what we're going to do about that in the future.
The Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack says the government is doing its part to lower greenhouse gas emissions, but he thinks bringing up climate change while the fires are still burning is in poor taste.
What people need now is a little bit of sympathy, understanding and real assistance. They need help. They need shelter. They don't need the ravings of some pure, enlightened and woke capital city greenies at this time when they're trying to save their homes.
Backing him up is his New South Wales counterpart, John Barilaro.
For any bloody greenie, lefty out there that wants to talk about climate change when communities are at risk and over the next 48 hours, we may lose more lives. And if this is the time that people want to talk about climate change, they are a bloody disgrace.
Most of Michael McCormack's criticisms were targeted at the Greens, who have been out in force today, laying part of the blame for current bushfires at the feet of the federal government.
Minister, why is the government ignoring these and other experts, and when will your government apologise to the people of New South Wales and Queensland
Order,
who are
Senator
facing
Waters,
these
time
fires?
For the question has expired.
That's Greens Senator Larissa Waters in Question Time. The Nationals' Deputy Leader Bridget McKenzie dismissed her attacks.
You know, Senator Waters, we do this dance, and usually it's with Senator Di Natale, so it's lovely to have a different partner today. But I don't know how often I can stand in this place and actually say I accept the science of climate change. Our government does. We have got a suite of initiatives across all portfolios to actually bring down and reduce emissions. So we can do that dance. We know that climate change is causing heat waves, fire weather and drought to become more frequent and intense. We know that. So that's why we've got a raft of measures across government to actually deal with this.
Professor Leslie Hughes, a councillor with the Climate Council, finds the political response disappointing. She says climate change should be above politics.
It's politicians like Michael McCormack that make it a political issue. If we just look at the science, we know that climate change is exacerbating the risk of severe bushfires. That's what we're seeing in New South Wales and Queensland now. So we need to be talking about it. We need to be prepared for it.
This is an extremely difficult time for many, many people and many, many communities, and everybody should be mindful of that. And certainly on the Climate Council, we are extremely mindful of that. But that doesn't mean we can put our heads in the sand and not talk about what's causing it. In order to protect communities in future and in order to adequately equip our firefighting services, the government needs to acknowledge that this risk is getting worse. And if they don't acknowledge that, they are letting everybody down.
That is Professor Leslie Hughes from the Climate Council here in Australia, speaking there with reporter Alexandra Beach.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, the fallout from the Kiribati government's decision earlier this year to switch its diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China is continuing, with a High Court ruling yesterday that's now cleared the way for a motion of no confidence against the president, Thanes Mamau. Now, the president has been running a minority government since earlier this month after 13 government MPs who were unhappy over how that switch had been carried out jumped ship. But attempts to launch a motion of no confidence by them has been blocked by the parliamentary speaker on the grounds that a similar motion had been moved only in August. But yesterday, the High Court in Kiribati ruled in favour of the opposition. The man who's leading the legal challenge told Pacific Beat that the president could lose his position as early as the end of the week, he believes, with expectations the motion will be heard later this week. But would a change in government then lead the small Pacific Island nation to backflip on its diplomatic ties with China? Our Pacific Beat reporter Evan Wasuka has been taking a look at this for us to try and work out what will happen. Evan, firstly, do we know for sure what the source of this difference or unhappiness is between the president and those breakaway MPs who are pushing for this vote of no confidence?
Well, Catherine, it all goes back to that decision to switch diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China in September. If you remember, both Solomon Islands and Kiribati switched ties around the same time. Now, while the Solomon Islands went through quite a long process of making up its mind to switch or not, Kiribati made that switch rather rapidly, catching many people by surprise. And it's how that happened that's been the cause of concern for many MPs. Now, those concerns only came to surface in early November when 13 MPs moved away from the government, leaving the president with only 21 MPs and a clear minority in the House. Now, since then, the opposition has been trying to oust the president through a motion of no confidence, but that had been blocked by the speaker until yesterday when the High Court ruled in the opposition's favour. This is what Banuera Berina, the man who led the breakaway from the government, had to say about the High Court decision.
I am happy. It is not an unexpected outcome. But of course, I was expecting this outcome because I verily believed that the speaker was wrong in the first place. Well, what we are doing now is that the speaker has instructed us to write a letter to him or to the clerk, asking them to have the motion listed for notice in the notice paper for consideration by the House.
Now, Mr. Berina says he expects the motion of no confidence to take place in coming days. He says the lack of trust in the government is leading this drive to change the president.
It is too closely connected to China. And what disappointed us was it has failed to acknowledge the contribution made by Taiwan for the last 16 or so years when Taiwan has been assisting Kiribati. And the picture that this government is painting of Taiwan is that it is making it appear as Taiwan had been here to do harm to us.
Well, that is Benawera Barina from the Kiribati First Party. Now, Evan, if the opposition is successful in changing the government, could it lead to a change in those newly re-established diplomatic relations that it has with China, as you say, given that that is the source of the tensions here?
Well, that's certainly one of the options that could come up if the opposition is successful. But as we've seen in Kiribati and to a lesser extent in the Solomons, these changes in diplomatic ties have a lot of implications, and it would be something that those in charge would have to weigh pretty heavily. Now, James Batley is a distinguished fellow at the Australian National University, and he thinks a reversal in policy is highly unlikely.
In the past, we have seen examples of countries in the Pacific
switching and then switching back again in reasonably short order. I think in this day and age, to my mind, that's becoming an increasingly unlikely scenario. And really the question for Taiwan is, you know, does it want to engage in these games? And is there a political cost back home in Taiwan for governments to be seen to be engaging in that game?
That's James Batley from the Australian National University. As for Banuera Berina of the Kiribati First Party, I asked him about his plans should the opposition be successful, and he says any new government that comes into place would be keeping its options open, and he says any decision would be in the best interests of Kiribati.
There is certainly room for China to stay, but as I mentioned, that depends on what China is prepared to do for Kiribati and the kind of benefit Kiribati will be getting from this diplomatic relationship.
That is Bonera Barina from the Kiribati First Party. Our reporter there, Evan Wasuka, and we'll keep you updated on developments there in Kiribati here on Pacific Beach. Well, Australian kids have been helping to bring light to communities in Papua New Guinea, working with an Australian charity that's called Solar Buddy. The students are building their own solar lights that are then sent off to children living in remote communities, most of them in PNG. Simon Doble is the charity's CEO and founder. He spoke with the ABC TV's news channel about it.
I invented something for the United Nations a few years ago and that introduced me to the renewable energy space and solar. And I decided that I wanted to engage more children and more communities around the world about what the issue of energy poverty. So we developed Solar Buddy to raise awareness about the issue, and then everyone makes a little solar light, which we then donate to children that live in energy poverty so they can study after the sun.
Just tell us about how it works.
It's been designed for children. It's got little eyes and arms and feet, so we humanised it a little bit. They put the solar panel out in the sun and it charges up, and then they use it at night to walk around their villages and study with.
And you've been involved in delivering these to the kids in these other communities. What's been the response?
Oh, it's amazing. Every day we distribute lights every week all over the world, but predominantly to Papua New Guinea. And being our closest neighbour, it's very important that we do that. And the response is fantastic. When my team talk in schools, we talk about Santa Claus turning up with Christmas presents or solar lights, and the children always would go for the solar lights. That's how important they are to the children, so it's really nice.
What do they make of the fact that it's powered by the sun?
It's amazing. It's
one of is that magic?
Yeah, exactly. It's wonderful. We actually designed it so the solar panel, if it's exposed to the sun, the light doesn't work, so the children don't waste the power during the day, so it only works at night time. But when you turn it on in the school and you cover the panel, so during the day, and it's amazing. It's like magic. So.
And, of course, they have 300 days of sunshine a year in Papua New Guinea, so it's a pretty good place to try this out.
Exactly. That's right.
How many lights have you delivered?
Approximately just over 118,000 now.
Wow.
So all across the world.
And what are your hopes for the rest for this project? You obviously want to continue it.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a big issue. There's about 1.4 billion people that are affected by energy poverty globally around the world. And our aim is to illuminate the lives of 6 million children. Mm. I have three beautiful children myself, and we're trying to 2 million children for each one of my children.
Do they help build the lights as well, your kids?
Not yet, but they will do. Mm. They will do soon.
Do you know what the lifespan of a light is?
Yeah, well, we change the lifespan is about 12 years. We change the batteries every 3 years. The batteries were recycled 500 times, which, based on what we know that the usage of the children using them, will last about 3 years. So we encourage the children to change their own battery, and then those batteries are sent back to China to be e-waste managed, and that extends the life of the light. So hopefully an 8-year-old child, 7-year-old child will use this light for the rest of their school life.
And are you going to have to go back in and deliver those batteries, or do the locals have a place where they can go?
We work with NGO partners, specifically in Papua New Guinea, an amazing NGO called the Kokoda Track Foundation, KTF. And we work with them to go back into the schools and the communities that we support to empower the children to look after their own rights, which is training in science, learning at the same time.
That was Simon Doble speaking about the Solar Buddy there with the ABC News Channel. Well, that is all for Pacific Beat. Don't forget, if you ever want to listen back to our stories or the full program, you can do so via our website. Just type Pacific Beat and ABC Radio Australia into your search engine. And, of course, we're also on Facebook, ABC Radio Australia.